I'm Allison Jacobson. I'm an alcoholic. And I remember meeting Randy at that Joe and Charlie thing. She was wearing a green and white pinstripe button-down shirt, and I thought she was so pretty. And Randy stayed sober after that, and I did not. My sobriety date is June 5th, 1993, and I'm very, very grateful for that. I guess I'll get into it. I've had a lot of bumps and bruises along the way, and, you know, on the way up here, it's such a beautiful, beautiful drive coming up here, and I was really early, so I stopped at Sheetz and went in there and got some stuff, and when I was leaving, there was this man walking behind the building with a bottle and chugging on the bottle, and I thought, wow. You know, what a vast difference, you know, him chugging on a bottle and then 3 feet away is somebody going to an AA meeting. And I remember when I was drinking, just being in fear all the time of financial insecurity because I've been evicted from almost every place I've ever lived. And just, you know, phones cut off, electricity cut off, can't afford groceries, bound so many checks, almost got arrested for doing so, and just credit card debt and all kinds of stuff. And I remember I used to be in fear of being homeless, and that did not happen. But I don't know why. I started thinking about that when I saw that man drinking behind the Sheetz. It was bizarre because the minute he took a swig off the bottle, it was just like you could see the relief in his face. And I remember that. I remember being relieved just knowing that I was on my way to go buy a 12-pack. Just going to the 7-Eleven or wherever, it was like, oh, thank you, God. I'm finally going to get some alcohol. Anyway, I am originally from upstate New York, and I lived there for the first 13 years of my life. I'm 44 now, so I kind of consider myself from Virginia now because I've lived here for so long. But I always mention upstate New York because that is where I started drinking. And really, quite frankly, if I never set foot in upstate New York again, I wouldn't care. I don't have any good memories of it. My mom still lives there, so from time to time I have to go there. But I just, it's not a place that I enjoyed. And I grew up in a house. My parents were married to each other and divorced from each other twice. And it's so weird. I actually, there's a man who speaks where he did the same thing, and I thought, my God, the only people I ever knew who did that were my own parents, and so I was happy to know somebody else had done it. So there was a lot of kind of chaos in our home growing up, but that's not the reason I'm alcoholic. It might have been the reason why I was a little bit angry, though. I don't know. At 13 was my first drunk, and a girlfriend of mine and two boys stole some alcohol from our homes, and my girlfriend had a fake ID and went and bought 2 6-packs of Molson Golden, and we met at the railroad tracks by this canal, and we were going to have a cookout and drink. And I had 4 Molson Goldens, a flask of Burgundy, and a flask of vodka, and threw up dinner, got taken home in an ambulance. It was just crazy. But I always say, before that happened, I felt incredible. Our book talks about the effect produced by alcohol. We, you know, that's why we drink, because essentially we like the effect produced by alcohol, and I absolutely loved it. All that time leading up to my taking my first drink, I always felt very inadequate. I was always fearful. I was angry. I was ashamed. And I don't even really know of what or why I felt this way, but whenever I was in a group of people, I was afraid to even speak. You know, after, hi, how are you, I didn't know what else to say. And sometimes I still don't know what else to say. But when I got some alcohol in my system, oh, my gosh, I felt better than you. I didn't feel inadequate. I didn't feel equal. I felt better. I felt relaxed. It was just like taking a deep breath out. And I was in a lot of trouble. I told you I got taken home in an ambulance. My mom and my aunt had to stay up with me while I vomited all night. And I got up the next morning, and I didn't remember part of the night. So from the very beginning, I was blacking out, and I've just always been a blackout drinker. And I knew I was going to be grounded. I knew, well, I didn't know for how long, but I knew, you know, my mom was going to be really, really angry at me and just that kind of look of disgust, like, how could you? And the whole neighborhood knew what happened because of the ambulance thing. And even with all that on my plate, it's not like I thought, my gosh, I am never going to do that again. Really, what I was thinking is, I can't wait. And I thought, I remember thinking that morning, if I can just get under control this vomiting thing and getting taken home in an ambulance, I'll have a lot of fun drinking. Never entered my mind not to drink again, because what I remembered wasn't the consequences that were bad. I remembered how I felt when I drank. And I was going to chase that feeling for a very long time, up until the time I was 27. And so that started it. That night started it. And with that, I didn't start drinking every day. I didn't start drinking in the morning back then. But when I drank, consequences always happened. People stopped wanting to hang around me because they knew we were going to get in trouble if I was involved in the scene. And eventually, what happened, how I ended up in Virginia, is my mother kicked me out of the house, and so she should have. She and I did not get along, and then when I started drinking, we didn't get along even worse. Sometimes when I think about how I treated her, even after making amends, I feel horrible about it, because I have a son of my own now, and I think to myself from time to time, gosh, I hope Jake never talks to me like that. I don't know what I'll do. And, you know, I'd tell her I hated her all the time. I'd tell her what a horrible person she was. I'd swear at her. I'd hit her. I stole from her. She would go to bed at night and lock herself and her purse in her room. And, you know, I was like 12, 13 years old. And how afraid are you going to be if somebody is, you know, small as me? But she was. She didn't know what to expect from me. She definitely could not trust me. And one weekend she went away to her sister's in Ithaca, and I had a party. I had it planned before she left. And what I didn't know was that she had told one of the neighbors to call her if they, you know, saw anything suspicious going on. Well, and they did. And when my mom came home, Ithaca was only 2 hours away from where we lived, and when my mom came home, people were sleeping in her bed, people had gotten sick on the carpet, people were doing drugs, and I was somewhere in that mix, and she just, that was it, something in her snapped. She had threatened several times to send me to go live with my dad. She had sent my brother there the year prior, and I just never thought she would ever follow through with it. And after everybody cleared out of the house, she just told me, she said, pack your stuff. You're going to be on a plane to Virginia tomorrow. You're going to go live with your dad. I've already called him, blah, blah. And I'm like, yeah, right. And I was really belligerent. I ought to add that into the bag of my defects of character. I was belligerent and absolutely disrespectful on top of being incredibly selfish and self-centered. And then I started crying because I thought, if I turn on the tears, maybe she'll believe that I'm sorry, even though I wasn't. I don't think I was sorry. I don't think I really got my conscience back until I was sober for a little while. I mean, it was just, I would plow over you and do what I needed to do to get what I want and just worry about it later. And then when I would get around to worrying about it, I really didn't care that I harmed you. So anyway, that's how I treated my mom. And so when she dropped me off at the airport, I actually believed that I was coming to Virginia. And when I got off the plane, my dad said, you know, I know you drink, I know you smoke cigarettes, and a few other things. I was stealing by then. I don't need a drink in me to steal. I will do that, you know, stone cold, cold sober. And I was doing a lot of this stuff before I even took a drink. But anyway, my dad was a military man, and he's very structured, and he just let me know that that wasn't going to be happening in his house, and it was happening within a week. You know, it just, that's how I am. Water seeks its own level, and it didn't take me long to find people, well, two people actually, not a whole bunch of them, two people who did what I did. And this girl, this one girl in particular, and I, gosh, we would go to the grocery store, take all these bottles of beer, go in the ladies' room, drink them, and then go to wherever we were going. I don't think you can get away with that today. There's too many hidden cameras and stuff, but back then they didn't have any of that stuff. We got in a horrible car accident one night. She hit a telephone pole, head on, going like 40 miles an hour. I don't remember the accident. And I remember when my mom and dad drove me by the telephone pole to, you know, teach me a lesson, I just looked at him like, are you kidding me? And I said, I wasn't even driving the car. And when I came to in the hospital, these people were squeezing glass out of my head because neither of us were wearing seatbelts. We, you know, I went through the windshield. And so anyway, I was having glass squeezed out of my head, and were inviting these hospital attendants to the grain alcohol party we had been at. I just, oh my God. And my parents heard us doing that. Oh God. And I just have a whole line of stuff like that. I mean, and none of that stopped me. 2 months after that car accident, I got arrested for driving while intoxicated. And the same officer who found the car after it hit the telephone pole was the same officer who arrested me. And he remembered me. And I was with the girl who hit the telephone pole. I remember him saying, you know, haven't you learned your lesson? And, you know, I didn't have any respect for authority. It was just in one ear, out the other, in one ear, out the other. And I always thought from a very early age that I knew what was best for me. And pretty much what that involved was if I liked it, then it was good for me. And that's what it was. So somehow I skated through high school. I graduated. I don't know how. You know, I used to be a good student before I started drinking. But once I start drinking, something interesting happens. Everything with meaning and purpose in my life eventually goes. People, activities, hobbies, interests, all that stuff, animals, anything in my circle that I love, if it gets involved, if it interferes with my drinking, it's gonna be cast aside from my life. And so I used to be a good student, and once I started drinking, I didn't care about school anymore. I, you know, skipped all the time. I don't know how I graduated unless they just kind of pushed me out. And I got into one college. I applied to like 5 or 6, and I got into one. And I was so excited to have been accepted at one. And 'cause I thought, well, this means, you know, I have a life of no rules, or really a life of Allison's rules, and I could not wait to get away from my parents, because by then they were married again, and I didn't like being in the house with them. And so I went off to college, and before I went, though, it's funny. I don't know if any of you have ever done this before. By the time I went away to school, people had started talking to me about my drinking. Obviously, my family had. But even by then, some of my friends, boyfriends, that kind of thing, people had even called me alcoholic. And I remember setting this bar in my mind, like a standard or something. If I ever do this, then maybe I will consider looking at my drinking. I never would say I'll stop drinking, but I might consider looking at it. And, you know, so I had all these things. Well, this hasn't happened to me. This hasn't happened to me. This hasn't happened to me. You know, I can't be that bad. Well, when I went away to school, almost everything on that little imaginary list of mine happened. I started waking up in places I didn't even remember going, looking at people saying, who are you? I passed out in a field in the middle of winter with no coat on. It was just absolutely insane stuff started happening, and dangerous stuff. Randy and I were having a conversation before the meeting. Just, we live in a different day and age now, and I'm lucky that nothing really horribly horrific happened to me, but it didn't. And so anyway, so I'm violating my own code is what's going on. And, you know, I had said, okay, if I start violating these principles, maybe I'll look at my drinking. And instead of looking at my drinking, I just lowered the bar. And it eventually got to a point where I had no code. You know, it was almost anything goes. I'd lie to you, steal from you, tell you I loved you all in the same breath as I'm, you know, taking your checkbook out of your back wallet. And that's how I did. I operated without a conscience for so long. And I'm not going to say I was okay doing that, but I needed a drink. And in college, I learned how to start drinking in the morning. My roommate professed to be one of us, but she had come to AA for a year and started drinking a week before school started, and so she and I were great friends, and we did a lot of drinking. And I remember one morning I woke up and just felt absolutely just so hungover. And she's like, here, Allison, you know, a beer will fix that. Well, ever since that day, I have always drank in the morning. And I just, I always say it was my absolute favorite time to drink, bar none. And so I, you know, I'm a morning drinker now. I can't get up and go to class. When I do go to class, I have this big, huge 7-Eleven cup full of alcohol to get me through the class. You can just imagine what my grades were like. So after the first semester, my dad gets a letter letting him know that I'm on academic probation. He got it from the school, and he gave me the lecture about we are not going to be paying for an education that you don't care about. And I really wanted to stay at school. That was important to me. I think it wasn't so much school as it was being out of the house. And I didn't want to work either because I'm lazy. And so I went back the next semester, and I really did try. And I somehow pulled off like a C average. But then I lowered. I did some stuff there that I was so ashamed of. I couldn't even go to the dining hall for a week. I had my roommate bring me salad in a cup, and that's how I ate for a week, and I had a seizure. And you know, you would think having a seizure is actually quite a scary situation. And I remember lying in the clinic thinking, oh my God, you know, maybe I do need to look at my drinking. And do you know, I was drunk that night. Absolutely drunk that night, because the scare for me only lasts about 3 or 4 hours, and then once I've got my breath back and I'm walking and I'm talking and everything is fine, well then who cares? I made too big of a deal out of that, and I'll go get drunk. So I'm doing stuff where I can't go in public. I'm having a seizure. Everything is crumbling around me. And so my solution when the going really gets rough isn't to change the way I'm living, it's to run away and start again. And so that's what I did. I didn't go back to school. I transferred to a school near where my dad was living. And I think I maybe made it to a few classes there, but you know, I could kick myself now. I never would withdraw. I would just not go, and I would get the F. And I could have withdrawn and at least just got the W, but I would take the Fs, and I had so many Fs. And in sobriety, I finally did go back and get my education. I was going to say, please don't let that be me. That happened to me once, and I was mortified. Anyway, I did go back and get my education in sobriety. And, you know, it's funny, you're drinking will catch up with you. I was so haunted by those transcripts. I remember the counselor at the school I graduated from asking me on the phone, they're like, well, what happened here? I thought, you don't want to know. Because I went through 3 colleges, blah, blah, blah. And what was happening at a very, very early age, by now I'm in my, like 20. And what was happening by the time I was age 20 was that alcohol was the main thing in my life. It was who I had a relationship with, I guess you could say. And I would do anything and everything to keep that relationship going. You know, I've already told you I'd lie, cheat, and steal and a few other things to get it. And as long as I had my alcohol and my cigarettes, I was okay. But if I didn't have that, oh my God, watch out. You know, I go into horrible withdrawal when I don't have alcohol in my system. And so that's pretty much what I was existing to do. I was existing to drink, and that was about it. I mean, I didn't do much else. By now, I don't have hardly any friends. I'm living in an apartment in Arlington, Virginia. I go to work sometimes because I'm a big caller and sicker, and I told you I'm a morning drinker. And when you're a morning drinker like me, you're a big caller and sicker. I told one job that the same grandmother died twice, and I did it like within a month of each other, and somebody caught me, and I was like, oh no. And I told you, you know, what do you do when the heat's on? You don't work it out, you run. So I never went back to that job. And I have a whole, I'm leaving this huge wake in my path and not even caring. And So at a very early age, alcohol had become my master. I love in Bill's story when he talks about that. Alcohol had become my master. And I remember being drunk, reading Bill's story, and thinking he had nothing to say. And then when I read it with Ernest when I was sober, I was like, my gosh, you know, I absolutely relate to everything this man is saying other than being a stockbroker and a man. But how alcohol affected his life and how he felt on the inside was me exactly. And so very early on, I started my round of treatment centers. I've been through four. I have been to psychiatrists. I've been to psychologists. I've been on pills, off pills. I've been diagnosed with attachment disorder, all sorts of stuff, you know. At the end of the day, I'm an alcoholic. And how I treat my spiritual illness is Alcoholics Anonymous. But at the time, my behavior was so bizarre. I was beginning to frighten people. My mom was always waiting for a call that told her I was dead, you know, especially since I got behind the wheel while intoxicated so often. My dad just, I don't know what my dad thought. Maybe he thought I was going crazy. A lot of people just said, oh, you're just depressed, you know. And if you have that much alcohol in your system, you're going to be depressed. You are. Alcohol is a depressant. And so I started going to treatment centers to appease people, to get them off my back. One morning, I will never forget it, my godmother called me. And I'm not kidding when I say this. It was like 5 in the morning, and it was on a work day. And I answered the phone, which was shocking because by then I really, you know, we didn't have caller ID back then, but I like to screen my calls through the answering machine because usually it was a bill collector. And then on the off chance that I answered when it was a bill collector, I just promptly hung up on them before they even got words out of their mouth. But anyway, at 5 a.m., my Aunt Linda called me. And she said, I'm calling you at this hour because I'm hoping that you're still sober. And I thought, oh, my God, who does she think she is? I got really ticked at her for that. And she said, you know, I'm really worried about you. I've talked to both your parents about this, blah, 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 blah. And I just thought, oh, my God, I wanted to hang up on old Aunt Linda, but I liked her too much. And so I thought, well, I'll just listen to what she has to say. And actually, while I was listening to her, I popped open a beer. And then I could listen a little bit better. And so so my Aunt Linda was on the phone crying, and I'm popping my beer and listening to this. And she's telling me I'm going to die. I'm going to make a mess out of my life. And you have so much potential. How many people have heard they have so much potential? And, you know, I hate just sitting back and watching you waste your life. That's what she was telling me. And so that was my first treatment center. And I thought, what do I have to do to get this lady to shut up? And so what I had to do, I guess, was go to a treatment center, and I went to one in Harrisonburg, Virginia, and, you know, it was fine. It was absolutely fine, but I could have cared less about staying sober. And the man who was my counselor there, because I broke all the rules in the treatment center. I won't get into what the rules are, but I broke them and got caught breaking them, and this counselor guy I had was—he was such a nice man, and he was so mad at me. I think, you know, I told you I just have no regard for your rules, your anything. And he just looked right at me. And he said, "You know what?" He pointed his finger at me, and I don't like that. And he said, "People like you don't stay sober." And I thought, and I still remember that to this day. And I wish I could even remember his name because I'd love to go see him. But anyway. Yeah, and gloat a little, I guess. I don't know. Well, he was right. I didn't stay sober. After leaving that treatment center, 2 hours, I'm not even gone, I'm buying a 12-pack at the pharmacy, and the Rite Aid or CVS or whatever it is, and I'm drunk, and I'm laughing about what I just learned in the treatment center. I even went back to visit that treatment center drunk, and they did a breathalyzer on me and told me to leave the property. It was just, and, you know, it's so funny how when we're drinking and we think nobody can smell it. And I've gone to many a meeting. I used to sponsor this gal, and it was so funny. I remember calling my sponsor and saying, I know she's drinking. I can smell it. I mean, it would have, if we had lit a match, she would have caught on fire. And And I even got to the point where I asked this girl, I said, you know, have you been drinking, just real casual? No. Oh, and she actually pinned it on the gal sitting next to her at the meeting. Oh, it must be so-and-so. Oh, yeah, they're having a real bad problem. And I'm thinking, And it's so funny how I can be, you know, totally drunk, and you'll ask me if I've been drinking. Oh, no. Or a couple or something, you know. But we think we're hiding something, and we're not at all. So I did. I went and visited that treatment center. I was drunk. They did the breathalyzer. They asked me to leave the property. So now starts the whole, I've got to hide my drinking because I've been through treatment, and everybody's expecting me to at least stay sober longer than 2 hours, you know. And that's just exhausting. It is absolutely exhausting. I spent the next 7 years trying to hide my drinking. And it's so funny. I mentioned earlier that I'm lazy by nature. I really am. But I put a lot of effort into hiding my drinking. It was insane. And now today, when I'm tired or I don't feel like doing anything, you know, I went to any length to drink. And that's how I have to talk myself into being willing to go to any length for Alcoholics Anonymous. I was telling Randy, usually I take a nap when my son takes a nap, and I didn't get to do that today. And, you know, I used to stay up so late before I had a child, and I can't pull that off anymore. And I was driving here, and my husband said, well, don't fall asleep in the middle of talking. And I thought, oh, my God, does he really think I might do that? But I'm a little tired. But anyway, I would go to any length to drink. I hid alcohol everywhere. And I lived alone, but you know, if I happened to be dating somebody, oh my God, I've got to get rid of all the empties. I didn't want to buy trash bags that you could see through, so I bought the big black lawn bags. Never mind, you heard them clinking to the dumpster, but that, you know, whatever. I didn't shower. I didn't clean my apartment. When I landed in AA, I hadn't had a shower in 3 weeks. I think that's roughly what I gauged it at. And in early sobriety, my now husband had to remind me to take a shower and take care of myself. I personal hygiene went out the window. Everything went out the window. And the last 6 months of my drinking were just very, very dark. I, you know, would work sometimes. I wouldn't work. I told you I was in fear of losing the place I lived in. I was in fear of losing my vehicle. Sometimes I had a phone, sometimes I didn't have a phone. There was a warrant out for my arrest for bouncing checks. It was just, I never had any money, and I know I made some, but, you know, it all went on alcohol. And it was just horrible. Our book talks about terror. And that's, you know, I would go to sleep every night, or really pass out, in sheer terror. And I would say a little prayer, and it wasn't, God help me, that's not what's going to come flying out of my mouth. It was, God, please don't let me wake up tomorrow. I couldn't, I was exhausted, I was afraid all the time, and I hated what had become my life. I did not intend to become the person that I was. You know, I don't think any of us do. And I would be bawling all the time, uncontrollably, and I was at that jumping off place. I knew I couldn't continue the way I was, but I could not imagine my life without alcohol. That just didn't enter my thoughts. Because not drinking was also equally as terrifying to me as continuing drinking, if that makes any sense. And you know, I told you, I've been in and out of the treatment centers, the psychiatrists, the psychologists, all this stuff. Well, I used to do this thing when I was drinking and had a phone called Drunken Dial. And, yeah, Billy's laughing. He knows what it is. You know, you call people at all hours of the night. Half the time I didn't even know who I called until I got the phone bill. No wonder my phone got cut off. I couldn't afford all these long-distance calls. And one night I called my brother. And, you know, it's bizarre to me to tell this story today. My brother and I used to have a very good relationship, and I used to talk to him, like, once a week. Now, granted, I was drinking most of the time, but we rarely even speak today, and if I have time, I'll talk about that a little bit. But it's funny how somebody who was so very instrumental in my sobriety and actually the whole path of my life is somebody who's barely in my life today. So I call my brother, And here's what I said. His name is Stephen, and I said, Stephen, I want to kill myself. And I'm crying. I'm so high drama. You know, I'm high drama, sober or drunk, but particularly after having had a few, I'm really dramatic. And I think it really, really rattled him that I said that. And I will tell you, though, for me to say that, what that means isn't that I want to kill myself. It's I need attention. Please stay on the phone and talk to me and tell me, oh, you're wonderful. It's okay. Don't do that. Blah, blah. Well, I think it really freaked him out. And so out of his mouth comes, Allison, my boss is in AA. And he's into this big book, and he's going to a big book study this weekend. Will you go if he can get you in? I thought I was going to drop the phone. I mean, talk about killing a buzz or whatever you want to call it. I was like, oh, my God, what have I gotten myself into now? And I was not going to waste a whole weekend on a big book study because I don't know who Joe and Charlie are. It was not the one that Randy was talking about. That was to come a year later. But I had to go, you know. I couldn't just not go. And my brother's boss is my now husband. And all these years going in and out of AA, I don't know what I thought AA was, but I would leave and say, AA doesn't work. You know, that's what I would tell my family. That's what I'd tell my friends. And I always just thought AA didn't work. Well, I get to this big book study, and I told you I've been through so many treatment centers, I had to find a big book that was packed away in a cardboard box. I mean, I had at least four because I've been through four treatment centers, and I had to go hunting for a big book to go to this thing. And I'm sitting in this Joe and Charlie thing, and they're going through the book, and I had absolutely no idea that the directions to take the steps which cure us of our spiritual illness are in this book. I was just blown away. And being in that group of people and meeting Al and stuff, I did not like Al when I first met him. He was far too enthusiastic for me. I was just like, oh, get away. But I heard something that weekend that I don't know if they were talking about it where I lived in Northern Virginia. If they were, I didn't hear it. But maybe this weekend I was just open enough to let something come in, and a seed was planted. And all these people had hope. They were happy. They were laughing. They were, you know, and they were all in recovery. And it's not like these people had perfect lives. It's just they were doing something. And my experience in Alcoholics Anonymous was I'd come sit in a meeting for an hour, I'd complain about my problems, and I'd go home and complain some more. You know, that's what I did. And I wondered why AA wasn't working. It never occurred to me to reach out to somebody else, ask them how they're doing, take the steps, do an inventory so I can be armed with the facts about myself so I can help you. Oh, my God, you did not enter into my mind. I thought I should enter into your mind, but you didn't enter into mine. And I'm surrounded by these people, and it was really amazing to me. It really, really was. And I did not stay sober after that. I was to have, I think, two more drunks. The last drunk I had, Al and I were living together. It was a Friday morning, not unlike any other Friday morning in my life. But because I have no solution operating in my life, what happens to me, I start getting irritable, restless, and discontent. And if I don't have a spiritual solution for my spiritual malady, the only thing I know how to do is get drunk. Either get drunk or kill myself, God forbid. And so, you know, it was upon me. I just felt like I was going to come out of my skin. And I knew the feeling. I felt it many times before. And I've actually experienced it somewhat in sobriety today. I just do different things now. So I went down to the store. It was 9 a.m. I got a 12-pack and a pack of cigarettes, and I started drinking. Started calling everybody I know, including my husband. He came home, got all the cash out of the house. It was already in my purse. And, you know, I try to think now, I can't imagine what that did to him. If I got a call from my husband today while I'm at work, it wouldn't matter where I was. If I got a call from my husband and he had told me that he'd been drinking, my whole world would stop for a few minutes. And, you know, I can't imagine what went through his mind. But what he did, nobody had ever done to me before. That evening, he looked at me and he just said, you know what, if you want to continue drinking, that's your business. Nobody had ever said that. And he said, but if that's what you're going to do, you can't do it here. And I thought, I was mad. I thought he ought to be begging me to stop. That's what I'm used to. Somebody, oh, I love you, please stop. Oh, blah, 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 I'll do anything for you. He did not say that. And I woke up the next morning and came back to AA, not with an honest desire to stop drinking, but with an honest desire to save my relationship and not get kicked out and be homeless. That's how I came to you. I don't think it matters why we come to AA. I really don't, whether it's a DUI, whether your wife sends you, your husband sends you, the court sends you, whoever sends you. Something has to happen, though, if you're going to stay. And that's what was ailing me before. I would come here. I had no problem coming here. I had a problem staying here. And so I came with this honest desire to save my relationship and not get kicked out of the house, and I hated it. I hated you. I hated everybody. And this one meeting in particular, I hated Wednesday Night Farmville, the Not Alone group. And I just knew all those women there hated my guts. And so, you know, rather than talk to them and actually strike up a friendship or a conversation with them, I'd just purse at them and ignore them. And then Al and I would be driving home and I'd say, see, they hate me. He's like, oh, my God. I remember one time, I think he was so sick and tired of listening to my complaining, he pulled the car over and he said, Allison, is there anybody that you like? And I thought, and, you know, once again, somebody startled me with the truth. And I had to think about it. I said, well, I like you. And he's like, I'm not talking about me. And I thought, God, I really don't. You know, I was always so busy trying to find fault with you because I felt so inadequate and empty on the inside. And it was way easier pointing the finger at all of you than to start dealing with that through inventory and amends and step 6 and 7 and prayer. And, you know, who wants that when I can just criticize everyone around me? And there was a guy I heard speaking once, and he said he used to root for the downfall of others. And, oh, my gosh, I did that. Even if I liked people, I would secretly hope that their life fell apart so I could feel better about mine for 5 minutes. And anyway, you know, you do that long enough in Alcoholics Anonymous, you're going to pay the piper at some point. And I found that is true with everything. You know, in our book, it says if we, you know, we need to be careful about letting up on this spiritual program of actions. We are in trouble if we do, for alcohol is a subtle foe. And any time, consciously or unconsciously, that I let up on this spiritual program of action, my life starts leaking. I either get testy with you, all of a sudden it's really hard to go to an AA meeting. I don't want to take your calls. I don't want to return your calls. Oh, my God, do I have to make coffee tonight? Why can't somebody else do it? You know, that kind of stuff starts happening. Or in my case, a lot of dishonesty started happening. I could rationalize, you know, not super big dishonesties, but our program is based on honesty. So if we're starting to lead this double life, that's dishonest. And I was resentful about AA, yet I didn't want to drink. The obsession to drink had been removed, and that really is by the grace of God, because it's not through anything on my part. But I wasn't taking AA seriously. I have a real big defect of mine is I still want to call the shots in my life. I get so fearful about the direction something might be taking. I think, okay, I've got to rein this in. You know, I need to rein this in, and I need to start going to work on it because I need to have the outcome that I want. And so at 9 years sober, I was a mess, just an absolute mess. I was crying all the time. I remember vividly, I live in the country and I work in the country, and I drive all these back roads to work, and I remember being on the gravel road just bawling my eyes out thinking, God, I just hate myself. And that's the first time I've been in that kind of emotional pain in sobriety. And the reason I got there is because I wasn't taking the steps. I wasn't, you know. I was not continuing to treat my illness with spiritual principles. And so when I disengage from that, I told you, something's going to happen. I'm going to pay the piper somewhere along the line. I just don't know where it's going to be. I asked people today that I sponsor. I got a call this week. A gal had, I always call them a bright idea. And because I've had lots of bright ideas. And I said, well, you know, you can do that. You just have to ask yourself, are you willing to pay the consequences? Oh, yeah, because, you know, we're always willing to pay the consequences when we want something. And I said, even if you don't know what those consequences may be. And that's the thing. I don't know, you know, I always say, oh, yeah, I'm willing to pay the price, you know, whatever. But a lot of times I have found out in hindsight, I don't know what that price tag is. I don't. So my life is leaking all over the place. I'm crying. I'm just in despair. And when I'm in despair and I don't want to look bad, I will find somebody to blame. And I just, you know, I pulled my husband out of the hat because why not? And I thought I had married the wrong man, you know. And, you know, here's a guy who I absolutely loved and adored, but I need him to, you know, to take the fall for my unhappy little life. And I'm not telling my sponsor any of this is going on. I called Nancy every week and just told her everything was great, everything's fine, blah, 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 lie, 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 lie. And there's no point in me having a sponsor if I'm not going to use them. And I learned a big lesson in that. That sponsorship is on me. It is up to me to be current with my sponsor. It's not up to her to pull all this information out of me. You know, she sponsors plenty of other people too. So I wasn't doing my part by keeping up that relationship. It was not her fault at all. And anyway, so I start blaming my husband. I tell him I want a divorce. I told him he made me feel weak and, you know, insignificant, and he burst into tears, and he did, and I think about it today, and he burst into tears, and he just said, what can we do to resolve this? And he said, I don't want to lose my wife, and you know, I had dug my heels in, because I told you, I'm lazy, I don't want to do anything. My MO for a very long time was to make a mess and have you clean it up. And if you're not willing to clean it up, well, then I need to run away and find a new mopper. And it really is a God thing. There's been so many bizarre coincidences in my life. Not only did I blame Al, but I blame my old sponsor, Nancy, too. So I got rid of her because, you know, she's not fixing my life. Never mind, I'm not even telling her anything that's going on in my life. But because of, you know, the fact she didn't fix me, I dumped her. A girlfriend of mine that I got sober with introduced me to this lady, Linda. And Linda, you know, Linda's no longer with us, but I fully believe that I probably wouldn't be married today if it weren't for the work she had me do to repair that marriage. She took me through the steps the way they're outlined in the book in such a meaningful way. I remember she asked me on one of our first conversations, she said, you know, is the way you're living okay with you? And I'm so snotty. And I said, well, sure. And she said, okay, I think she thought I was going to break down in that question. And so she said, okay, let me ask you another question. And I said, okay. And she said, is the way you're living okay in God's eyes, do you think? And I told her, I said, I don't know because I don't have a God. And she was the first person I admitted that to. And something told me that if I just wasn't honest and put all my cards out on the table, I was never, ever going to get better. At that point, it wasn't about saving my marriage, having children, any of that. I just wanted to, for one day, not want to kill myself, you know, in sobriety. I mean, I was used to that feeling when I was drunk, but I don't know how many of you have been sober and just wanted to just lay down and end it. And I didn't like that all too well. And here was this just amazing woman put in my life, and if I was honest with her and was willing to do some work, then maybe I could repair all this spiritual malady flying on in my head. So I agreed with her to go through the steps from 1 through 12 and to go through the traditions 1 through 12. And it absolutely changed the direction of my spiritual path. I had to make amends to Al because, as it turns out, it takes two to tango, and not everything was Al's fault. And, you know, I really wanted to eat dirt rather than make amends to him. And there's a lot of people I would have rather eat dirt than make amends to. But I go do it because I'm told that I will not overcome the drink problem if I don't. And also, I need to have experience to pass on to the women I'm sponsoring. I can't very well go tell them to pay money back when I've got, you know, $25,000 of credit card debt sitting around. And so she helped me get a lot of stuff cleaned up. I had to go back and make amends to my mom because it turned out I really didn't make any genuine amends to her either. And I was 12 years sober when that happened. And do you know, after being sober that long, my mom still had a list of the ways I had harmed her, at least in her head. And she told me what I needed to do to make it right. And I still try to do it. Really, what that amounted to was she wants to be a part of my life. And so even though it's painful sometimes, I will call her once a week. I just paid for her to come down in January because I told you we have a son now, and, you know, she wants to be involved in his life. And she couldn't afford to come down. And my sponsor today said, well, can you afford to buy her a plane ticket? And I looked at the phone like, are you kidding? And I think that even came flying out of my mouth. I said, are you kidding? And she said, no, I'm not kidding. Can you afford to bring your mother down here? And I was like, oh, my God. Well, do you know that? My mom was like, this is just one of the nicest things you've ever done. You know, thank you so much. And Linda, the gal who really put my life, gave me the tools to help me put my life in a different direction, she died suddenly of a stroke. Randy and I both knew her very well, and so did Jody, and so did Lynn. And so there I was again in the position of having to find another sponsor. And I got a lady that I'd known, I guess now I've known her for like 12, 13 years almost. And she comes to mine and my husband's convention every year. And I'd gone through a couple people by then. I'm such a impulsive person. I think, okay, Linda's dead. I've got to get the first person who walks through the door. Can you be my sponsor? Can you be my sponsor? And anyway, the lady I have now, I've had for almost 3 years, and it's been working out really, really well. She's introduced me to a different dimension of AA that I hadn't been familiar with for a very long time, and that's our fellowship. You know, we've got three sides to the triangle. And I sometimes will be really involved in one, like the recovery part, but maybe forget the fellowship or, you know, forget a lot of it. And Beth has got me back into fellowship, and it's, my boss calls me antisocial, and you know, there's a lot of antisocial people in AA, and I think Beth had been my sponsor for like a day, and she said, well, I do this, it's like a retreat, but she calls it an advance, and she said, I do this advance, and it's coming up this weekend, why don't you come, that'd be a great way for you to get to know everybody, blah, 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 and I'm like, are you kidding? I don't want to go with 25 women that I don't know. And I told a lie. I told her I had a commitment that weekend. And she, and Al was sitting on the bed and he's looking at me like, you do not. And so anyway, she said, well, why don't you find a way out of that commitment so you can come to North Carolina? And I'm like, oh my God. And she told me I could bring somebody. I called every woman that I sponsored at that time, and nobody could go. And I was like, oh, no. And so I went by myself, and it was probably the best thing in the world for me because things that are uncomfortable for me help me grow. I get something out of it somehow. And I went to that weekend like a little kid in high school, you know, their first day of school and doesn't know anybody, and I'm slipping around. I'm afraid to talk to anybody, and I made friends with people who are still my friends now. And I just had an incredible weekend with all those women. And now I go every year and I do bring people with me. And I never used to be a fellowship person. I thought the fellowship stunk. You know, I'd get to the meeting like kind of right before it started and I'd pretty well leave right after because I didn't want to talk to you. I didn't want you to get to know me. And now I'm being forced to put myself in positions that I normally wouldn't. And it's been absolutely wonderful for me. It's a new dimension of my sobriety. I think I'll end with my life today. It's far better than what I deserve. I've mentioned my son a couple times. You know, my husband and I off and on tried for a lot of years to have a child, and I went through a lot of heartache with that. And then in August of 2008, we had our son, Jake. And it was really funny because before I gave birth to him, my sponsor told me, and I guess she must be used to this by now, a lot of people, once they have children, they drop out of AA. You never see them anymore. And she said, you know, just because you're having a child doesn't mean that you can't, you know, that you don't go to AA. And she said, I'm fine with you changing up your schedule or your meetings or stuff, but you still need to go to a lot of meetings. I go to at least 4 meetings a week and most of the time 5. And I was like, oh. And I had a hard time with it in the beginning when Jake was first born. I got resentful at AA again. I thought, oh, my God, you know, don't you understand? I have a kid. And I'll make it personal now. When I started sponsoring Lynn, she has 4 kids. And I remember one time asking Lynn to do something. And I think one of her kids had a commitment. And she got mad at me for asking her to do this. But she did it. And I thought, oh, dear, you know. And so here I am driving home so mad at AA because I don't like leaving my son with a sitter. And I just know I'm going to miss something important. And, oh, he's going to grow up hating me because I'm not home. And I just all kinds of craziness went through my mind. And then I would think of that time with Lynn. And I thought, well, Lynn did it. So can I. And so, you know, it's just what I do. And hopefully my son will grow up loving AA. You know, he knows a lot of the people in AA already. I was leaving tonight and he said, Mama, AA meeting. And he knows what they are. But what I'm bringing it back to is my primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics achieve sobriety. Whatever I put in front of my sobriety, I'm going to lose. And I've done that so many times. I spent 9 years putting things in front of my sobriety, and I don't, you know, they're all gone. They've stayed gone. If I start putting my son before my sobriety, that's tricky. I think I'm a better mother today because I have you, and I want to thank you for that, and thanks for having me. Mm-hmm.